Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, the Network for Social Justice, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is James Alaya. He is a Democratic candidate running in the 71st Assembly District against incumbent Assemblyman Randy Vopel, a Republican. He is the president of the Minority Humanities Foundation and an accountant by trade. James, welcome to the show.
Miriam, thank you so much for having me today. I really want to compliment you on making the decision to cover this for the constituents in the 71st District and affording them the opportunity to hear about what I have planned and what I plan on bringing to Sacramento for them.
Well, thank you very much, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and share your views with our listeners. Let's start by asking you why you were running for public office and what made you choose this race in particular.
You know, Miriam, it's funny. Even a year ago from today, I never would have imagined that I'd be doing this. You know, a year ago, I was still just totally in shock and awe of what the country has become and what's really been happening in our society. And, you know, I told myself, I said, that's it. I'm going to get involved. I had always been plugged into the nonprofit world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've always done refugee work. I've always done community work. So I've had exposure to politics. I was always around politicians anytime they wanted a good photo op or anything like that. So
there you were.
I was always involved, but I was never persistent in penetrating this field. So I had just decided, you know, I was going to do everything I can to improve my community.
Well, it's very interesting. In the last two races in the 71st Assembly District, the Democrats didn't field a candidate at all. So voters were basically choosing between multiple Republican candidates with no progressive voice in the race. I would like to ask you, James, what you consider the most important issues facing not only our state, but this district in particular.
Miriam, there's a myriad of issues that's really facing our district currently that I'm very concerned with, you know. And to address not having any Democrats run, I think has been absurd. I think we as Democrats have failed the public. We have not given them an option. That's a big reason why I want to bring my platform, is to give that option again. Voter registration just came out. It's updated.
Mm-hmm.
There's only 495 more registered Republicans in the entire city of El Cajon than there are Democrats.
Wow.
So the gap has closed, and that's why my platform and the issues are very important, you know?
For listeners who may not know what assembly district they're in, what does the 71st Assembly District include geographically?
Oh my gosh, the 71st District is a beast. It is a very large district. It runs from the Tecate border all the way up to Morongo and Palm Desert.
Wow.
As far west as Valley Center and very few parts of La Mesa, and as far east to the Imperial Valley line.
So it includes most of East County, but also some portions of Riverside County?
That is correct. Morongo, Idlewild, Anza, Borrego Springs, those are all the Riverside portion that cover the district.
So you're going to wear out a lot of shoe leather if you try to do the walking door-to-door in this district.
Oh, I've been logging miles. Don't even worry about that.
I'll bet.
Yeah, they're wearing thin.
Okay. So back to the issues. Mm-hmm. What do you consider the single most important issue facing this district?
Look, facing this district, we really have to do something in regards to affordable housing. It is a crime that people are being outpriced and having to move further and further and further and further east, when the option was always moved to East County. That's where it was affordable. People
yeah.
can come here.
Yeah.
They can live here. They can have a decent home and drive a decent distance to work. That's not the case anymore.
Yeah, now we're seeing homelessness on the rise, and San Diego County in general is among the top five or six most expensive housing markets in the nation. Million-dollar question, of course, is what do you do about it?
Well, Miriam, first off, we need to start having accountability at the local level. So we already have laws in place to prevent this from happening. The only problem is they've gone ignored for far too long. You know, I don't want to sit up here on a pedestal and say Republicans are responsible for this, Republicans are responsible for that. I think there's equal blame out there. You know, we have the very serious regulation called the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act.
Mm-hmm.
According to the CRA, developers, banks, anyone that has to do with building homes cannot outprice residents. They can't do that. Why do we have a new development in El Cajon on Chase Avenue where prices are $600,000 for houses.
Yeah, that's not affordable to the average family, certainly. And El Cajon, we should add, has the highest poverty rate in the county, or at least they're tied with Escondido last I checked.
Absolutely, Miriam, you are correct on that. One out of every three children are living in poverty. I found it heartbreaking that I toured El Cajon High School with a couple of staff members, and there were students that were going to the lunch line, and it was humbling to see this. They were getting their lunches, walking away from the line, opening their backpacks and putting it in their backpack. As a teacher, I'm like, why are they putting it in their backpacks? They said they're taking it home to feed their families.
Oh, gosh, that is heartbreaking. We know that there is very high poverty in rural parts of East County, too. There are some school districts out in the furthest east areas, Boulevard, Campo. There are areas where the schools have 60% of the children on the federal school lunch program, which means their families are living below the poverty level, but they don't even count the poverty rates for those communities because it's lumped in with the entire county unincorporated areas. So as a legislator in Sacramento at the state level, what would you do to try to improve this situation and make housing become more affordable and available to people here?
Well, first off, we have to start holding municipalities accountable for the current laws on the books. So city councils should not be issuing permits for developers. They should not be giving land away without negotiating price first. There has to be some sort of price negotiation. And I get it. Cities want to get rid of land so it can start creating tax revenue. But at what point do you say we have a moral obligation? We have to start actually looking out for the citizens instead of just creating tax, creating tax, creating tax. So number one, we need something in place to enforce the current legislative laws. On top of that, you know, we have Senator Tony Atkins, who just had a wonderful proposal that brought $250 million toward affordable housing, which is a good start. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to build off that platform. We really need to start lobbying the housing committees. We really need to start getting back down to the nitty-gritty of what are we going to do at the municipality level to make sure people are going to not be homeless.
Yeah, so maybe getting them to follow the state laws, but also maybe funneling more money into the local governments to have to work with to provide housing that would be affordable for people.
I think so. It's crisis number one, because when you have people on the streets, you go from a homeless issue to a health issue now.
Yes, you know, hepatitis.
As you've seen with hepatitis. Believe me, it's not a myth. It's not made up, the fact that the rise in homeless has caused an outbreak in hepatitis. And that's a problem because we don't have the resources for them to fix that.
Yeah, it actually started here in East County. They're saying patient zero is believed to be in El Cajon.
So. Yeah, you know, and so you can come up with whatever you need. You need public restrooms. You need washing stations. You need proper resources for the homeless. But that's putting a Band-Aid on the bigger problem. The bigger problem is they don't have a place to stay.
Well, it really is. And with the price of housing so high, it's become difficult even for people who wouldn't have been classically among the homeless population. You know, they're not drug users or alcoholics or mentally ill or some of these other categories. These are just people who maybe lost a job. Mm-hmm. Senior citizens who are trying who are struggling to get by on a fixed income, and you know the rent goes up, and all of a sudden they're on the streets. I know people who've had to sell their car to pay their rent. It's crazy, and there are people who work their entire working lives, and now they're retired and can't make ends meet anymore. So it is a very serious problem, James. Mm-hmm. You mentioned hepatitis. Speaking of medical issues, I think one of the number one things that people are concerned with, not only in East County and California, but all across America, is the healthcare system. We are seeing the Trump administration basically sabotaging the Affordable Care Act. The tax bill that was just passed by the Senate takes away the mandate under Obamacare, which is ultimately, according to the experts, the Congressional Budget Office, going to throw a lot of people off of healthcare if Obamacare even survives at all. It's going to be more expensive and more people can't afford it. Are there things that the state of California legislature should be doing or could be doing to try to protect the healthcare options for people in our state, at least?
Absolutely, Miriam. And you know, healthcare is something that's near and dear to me. When I was designing my platform and I was researching issues, I didn't want to jump on the healthcare train because I said it's such a populist idea right now that people are just saying it because it's a popular idea. till I got to the numbers. And then I realized 19% of the 71st district does not have healthcare.
Wow.
That's a big problem.
It's almost one in five people.
Exactly. So that's a big problem for me. So I'm a big proponent and supporter of SB 562. SB 562 is single payer healthcare in the state of California.
Oh, okay.
It was shelved. It passed through the assembly and it passed through the Senate Appropriations Committee. Mm-hmm. And it's actually coming back to legislation in 2018.
That's very exciting.
Yes.
Of course, the big question with it, if the folks on the other side of the aisle were sitting here, I'm sure they'd be saying, you know, it's a nice idea, but where's the money going to come from? How will you fund this?
So, Miriam, you know, number one, my response to that is anytime you have people that are higher than you on the economic scale telling someone who's poor they don't need something, they're probably trying to manipulate them. And so there's this facade that, you know, we're going to bankrupt California because of single payer healthcare and tuition free college and all these social programs that we want to give to people that, mm-hmm. that are rights. They are not something that's a privilege. These are rights. Healthcare, education. You have the other side of the aisle that's telling you, oh, who's going to pay for it? Who's going to pay for it? You know what? If you sit down and you look at the numbers, we currently spend around $360 billion a year on healthcare in California.
True.
The estimate, according to SB 562, is $400 billion. So they're talking about how, oh, it's going to cost us $400 billion. No, it costs us an extra $40 billion, and that's without price negotiations.
Now, that's an interesting number because I note that part of your platform calls for creating a public bank in California. And how much do you estimate? You're an accountant. You know how to crunch numbers. How much do you estimate California could save if they set up their own public bank?
Funny you ask, Miriam. $40 billion just in remittance fees alone. So that could buy a lot of health care.
There goes. Yeah, the state brings in how much in revenues each year?
State brings in anywhere from $500 to $600 billion a year in revenue.
But it's all going into federal banks right now?
Or? It's all going into private institutions. It's going into Wells Fargo, who in turn takes that money and creates fake accounts. And they use your identity to commit fraud. And then they pay a penalty that's a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, for listeners that didn't hear that, they were nailed for this recently, for creating, you know, fake accounts for people. And just today as we're taping this, it's come out that the California Insurance Commissioner, Dave Jones, is calling for the revocation of their insurance license because it turns out they were doing a similar fraud, allegedly, where they were having people fill out insurance applications and without their permission, putting those through and actually getting policies. They told people it was just for quotes. It was really for policies. So this is where our money's going right now. And instead, it could be actually going into a California state bank. I mean, it sounds like a brilliant idea. How come it hasn't been done so far?
Follow the money, Miriam. As you know, the banks are one of those industries that are just almost impossible to take down.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much they mess out, they mess up, they get bailed out. No matter what wrong they do, they're always given a slap on the wrist penalty compared to what they made for the wrongdoing. And so I don't think we should reward bad behavior. I think if a corporation, regardless if it's banking or not, wants to continuously abuse the public, we need accountability and transparency. Now, we have all the means to house our own money. We have all of the means to create our own bank. Now, the best thing about a public bank is, number one, you save on those remittance fees. So we no longer have to pay $30 to $40 billion a year to Wells Fargo to move our money. We can keep it in-house. There's no more remittance costs.
Interesting.
We can save 50% on all of our infrastructure projects by not assigning letters of credit anymore. We can save 50% on that. So with this new 11-cent gas tax that just came in, we can revert back very quickly if we're saving 50% on all of our infrastructure projects. We could build a lot of roads really quick if it's 50% of the cost.
Correct. Well, assuming it doesn't get repealed, there's a ballot measure to, you know, to try to undo that.
Yes.
I would like to ask you about a couple of the hot button issues. Whenever we interview candidates, we always like to kind of ask you about issues that maybe people in your party would care about, as well as what some people on the other side of the aisle would care about. On the social issues, women's rights, reproductive rights, abortion, gay marriage, some of these hot-button social issues, where do you stand? Are your views and values in line with the traditional Democratic Party platform?
Absolutely. I align 100% with progressive Democratic politics. I believe in a woman's right to choose. I'm a supporter and advocate for gay marriage. I'm right on par with all of that. You know, once you get down to the ideological issues, it always comes back to money. So here's the big issue. Okay, if you really want to solve abortion, you really want to get rid of abortion. It's a cultural and socioeconomic issue.
You know, that's a very interesting point, because a lot of people don't know that the number one reason that women give if they go into an abortion clinic seeking one is that they say they cannot afford to have the baby. It's easy to say, have that baby when you're an unwed mother, for instance, or even a married woman who maybe has lots of kids already and no income coming in. But if it costs $40,000 on average just to deliver a baby, and now we're talking about taking away the health care maybe and not providing, you know, child care, not providing health care for the baby after it's born, not providing maternity care, that's a pretty tough thing to do. So, you know, you're right. In a situation where it's healthy baby, healthy mother, I think most people, you know, would probably wish there was a way that that life could be spared, but not on the financial back of a poor woman.
You're absolutely right. And what we're doing, we're morally bankrupt as a society for having this argument. Mm-hmm. You know, because the true issue is that we are terribly, as a society, terribly, terribly putting women at a disadvantage. We really are. There is a real issue with equal treatment, equal pay in our society with women. I was speaking to a conservative group and I told them, I said, okay, you want to solve abortion? I have a platform for that.
Let's hear it.
My platform is this. We need to start paying a livable wage. We need to bring minimum wage to 20 or 25 bucks an hour. We need to better arm women to make decisions for themselves. That way they don't have to make a decision that they're forced to make. Give them choices. Give them an opportunity to make that decision. So if money's an issue, great. Get on board with me. I've been saying that I've been fighting for $20 an hour for a long time.
Wow.
I think $25 an hour would be more appropriate for the state of California. But let's support a more livable wage. And you want to know the response that I got? The response I got is, well, I own a small business. I don't want to have to pay that much money. Ah. So then abortion's not your number one issue.
It's economics then. It's very, very interesting. That does beg the question, with a $20 or $25 minimum wage, would you, if you could wave your magic wand and have that be the law tomorrow, would you phase that in and would it apply equally to all size businesses, or would there maybe be a staged approach so that, you know, the little guy running a restaurant with, you know, three family members or something wouldn't be hit with it as hard as, say, a Walmart or somebody who could better afford to absorb the cost of a minimum wage going way up?
Miriam, as someone who has owned multiple businesses in the past and helps with business development with organizations, I can tell you right now, a happy, healthy workforce is such a positive effect on business owners. That little shop owner, if he's willing to pay 20 bucks an hour to his employees, will see more sales from his employees. He will see less of a turnover rate. He's going to see a happier workforce. He doesn't have to spend money training anymore because he's going to have a longer tenured relationship with his employees. His employees are in turn going to spend money at his restaurant. He's going to open up his buying power and his bargaining power now. And besides that, we have a lot of what we call moral shoppers in the state of California. People like supporting business that take care of their people. We have a great labor movement here. It sounds tough on paper when you look at it and you say, you know what, I'm barely getting by. How am I going to afford to do this? And I'm a firm believer if you invest in the American worker, it will pay off 10 times over.
Okay. Where do you stand on the Second Amendment and gun issues, which have certainly been all over the news lately with these mass shootings in Vegas and so forth? And on the other side of the coin, we've had, you know, movement on the other side where people are trying to make it easier to do concealed carry everywhere. Where do you come down on the issue?
I believe in the Second Amendment. I mean, it was put into society to protect citizens against a tyrant in government. We have every right to bear arms in this country. Now, with that being said, can we really justify owning assault rifles that fire 640 rounds per second? We are more likely to use weapons on ourselves than against an intruder or someone breaking into our homes.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at the Second Amendment, I say, yes, by all means, we have every right to bear arms, but that doesn't mean we have the right to any type of arsenal we want.
So hunting rifles, a pistol maybe for self-defense, things like that.
Absolutely. And I'll even go as far to say as, you know, I find it quite absurd that we have the ammunition law. I don't think somebody should have to have a special permit to buy ammunition. I don't think somebody should have to have a license for ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
They got the license to purchase a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
What that does is that hurts people who are recreational hunters. It hurts people that just enjoy the sport of shooting, that just want to go have fun and go to a shooting range. It doesn't hurt these people that want to cause harm. It doesn't hurt the people who, you know, want to go on these shooting sprees. It doesn't hurt them. It hurts responsible gun owners. I don't like the ammunition law. I think it should be much more easier for someone to get a concealed weapon permit. I think the state already has a very tough process in place. Mm-hmm. And if you meet this rigorous process, by all means, you have a legal right to have a concealed weapon.
Should more be being done on the other side of it to prevent these mass shootings that just seem to be a daily occurrence now? In the U.S., I should add, not elsewhere in the world.
Absolutely. I think on both sides we should be working on it. I can't even see how this is a partisan issue. We all should be concerned with gun violence. Mm-hmm. Republicans, Democrats, everyone. We just have two stark differences as to what is the remedy. One side says we need less guns. One side says we need more guns. You know, there's no fine line, more or less. Well, I think if we basically continue with the process we have, but make it a much more thorough process, I think that's where the benefit is. I think
that's a better background checks.
Better background checks, mental health checks, I think are the big one, because you see these mugshots of these guys.
Yeah, the crazed stare. It's like the Manson stare.
Yeah, you know? And after they get done with these, you find out these guys were sociopaths, bipolar. They had these crazy disorders. Well, why don't we start passing mental health checks when it comes to purchasing a weapon?
Yeah, very good point. On another issue, what about education? There seems to be, you know, quite a split difference there between whether the money should be going for strengthening public education or going for things like, you know, vouchers and private schools and charter schools.
I'm a recipient of public education. A vast majority of the public takes public education. If you're a private school, if you're a private entity, you're already charging a lot of tuition fees and you've already got your revenue sources. Why are you trying to take from poor communities as well? I'm not a big fan of vouchers for private schools. I'm not a big fan for community block grants for charter schools. I don't support that. I support going into communities where historically we have had terrible education numbers, where we go into the barrios, where we go into the African American community and give them the same fair equal education that we're going to give the people in La Jolla and Del Mar.
Could include the poor districts out in some of our rural areas.
Of course. I've been to Mountain Empire High School, mm-hmm. and they are severely underfunded.
Very much so. I mean, they actually had a school shut down because it didn't meet state standards out there for middle school.
And so when you're dealing with land masses out there, one middle school shuts down in Boulevard or in Campo.
Yeah. Hakamba has no school at all left. The children there have to be bused somewhere else now.
Exactly.
It's a town with no school.
And you're driving 20, 30 miles to get to El Cajon or Alpine because you're guilty of living in the mountains.
Yeah.
It's literally a war on poverty. They're taking poor communities and they want to move money from the poor communities and give it to, well, affluent communities. And there's no way around it. And I'm not going to beat around the bush. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. If you go to Poway High School, you're favored over someone who goes to Monta Vista High School.
Okay.
And it's not right.
Let's talk about climate change. Arguably, some would say the most important issue, not just for California, but for the nation and the world. Your opponent, Randy Bopel, back when he was mayor of Santee, before he was an assemblyman, famously told a group of climate change activists, "Have fun at your Wreck the Economy party for one of their events. I like it hot."
Yeah. This is a very stark difference between myself and Randy Bopel. He's a climate change enthusiast. He might be the only person in the world that is completely okay with climate change. He acknowledges it's there, and he thinks it's a good thing.
He organized a conference at San Diego State, I believe it was, where he brought in a famous climate change denier who actually had been really debunked. If you just Googled the guy, he was claiming to be a member of the House of Lords. The House of Lords said no, he wasn't. But he was, for some reason, putting this forward. So how do your views differ?
You know, my views differ because I actually believe in science. I think that that should be the staple that we should be going off of. We shouldn't be going off of feelings. You know, Randy feels like climate change is not a big problem. He feels like it's not an issue. Well, the reality is he's got his ties on a little too tight. He needs to clear his head and actually listen to the scientific evidence that's being presented to him, because I'll give you a really good example right now. It's December. and California's on fire. 10 years ago, fire season got done in October. Mm-hmm. We're now fighting wildfires at Christmas time.
It's true. You know, I will say that I've interviewed an awful lot of firefighters and fire chiefs in my time. We also run a wildfire emergency alert service, as you know. I have yet to find a single fire chief who didn't believe that climate change was real, that it was man-made, and that we should be doing a whole lot more about it than we are. I mean, as we're taping this, and it may be worse by the time this airs, we're seeing fires all over Los Angeles, all over Ventura County. They had one in Ventura that had burned all the way from the mountains to the sea. Hundreds of homes lost in these areas. You know, tens of thousands of people evacuated. It shut down many major freeways. You know, the winds are kicking up here as we tape this on a Wednesday to be airing on our Monday show. What would you do to help combat climate change in your role as a legislator?
So first off, we have to all be on board with community choice energy. There has to be other options out there versus what we're doing. We have to pass the ban on fracking. No fracking in the state of California. We live on a very dangerous fault line. Mm-hmm. We have to lower our emissions. In regards to preserving us directly here in the 71st, we need to invest in fire prevention versus emergency response. You know? So if you take a look at the southern Sierra Nevadas in Mexico, they have wildfires too, but they are so controlled and they literally burn out very quick. And the reason why is because they've come back to the way indigenous people would combat fire and prevention. So what we do here is we create matchboxes. We just go and we cut down fire lines and it creates a lot of shrub and it grows back even more susceptible to fire because now you have all this shrub at the bottom that burns quicker. What we need to do is instill selective logging where we actually go into the forest and we select what we're removing. We're removing dangerous shrub, not all of it. The other thing we need to do, we really need to look into what SB 1122 was. We really need to start focusing on the benefits of biochar. So with biochar, we could spread it all throughout the soil. It preserves the soil in case there is a wildfire. That way we could regrow again. But it also limits the spread. It prevents it from further burning and further spreading. It creates like a natural break. So we have a lot of things that we can do to start combating it, but prevention is key. And it starts with protecting our environment, number one.
You have been a big advocate for refugees. And we should say that in San Diego County, our county takes in more refugees from around the world every year than any other city in America now, more than New York City, more than Los Angeles. And a lot of those people are here in East County, where we have 50 or 60,000, I think, Iraqi Chaldeans and other Middle Eastern refugees, as well as more and more people coming from Africa and Asia, other parts of the world. Tell us about the work you're doing for the Minority Humanitarian Foundation.
Correct.
And what that's all about.
Yeah, so the Minority Humanitarian Foundation was founded years ago by our founder, Mark Arabo. I was sort of just a kid trying to do good work. And I was working out of the trunk of my car. And I was basically helping any way I could. So I was not organized. I was literally getting calls at 3 o'clock in the morning that says, hey, a family just got here. Can you find places for them to stay? And that's how I was doing my work. Mm-hmm. I was finding furniture, getting it donated, getting them anything I could, clothes. My goal was to not say no to any refugees. So anything from helping them with job applications to helping them with their school paperwork to doing taxes for them is work that I was doing. Mark came along and he said, you know, I really respect what you've done for our people. Why don't you come into the foundation a little bit? The most important thing that we have to do is we have to change at the legislative level. He goes, you're doing great work, but in hindsight, you're not doing anything. You're, again, putting a Band-Aid on a situation.
Interesting.
Your work is going to be forever because we're always going to be a nation of immigrants. We're always going to have people coming here. And as long as there's tensions in the Middle East, which let's say we don't have a solution, there's always going to be Iraqi refugees coming here. So he said, what we have to do is we have to do something at the state and the federal level. So what we do with the Minority Humanitarian Foundation, specifically we work on public policy. We do still offer all those other services. You know, when people call us, the last big issue that we had was with the deportees.
Yeah, I was going to say, under President Trump, we've seen a huge increase in deportations, not just of Mexican or Latino immigrants, which is so much of the media focus has been on, but recently in Detroit, I understand, they were rounding up Iraqi immigrants who were at the time supposed to be protected under our agreement with the Iraqi government, mm-hmm. and yet many of them were being rounded up and facing deportation, people who'd maybe had a minor infraction with the law years and years ago and had been law-abiding ever since then. So you've been involved in helping people locally on that issue, I understand.
Absolutely. So there was approximately 1,200 Iraqis on this list that they wanted to pick people up for deportation. Now, this just shows you the maturity level of the president and how much of a child he really is.
It's dangerous to send them back, we should add. They could be killed or displaced if they were to go back.
Here was the argument. The argument from the State Department was that Iraq is safe. It's a safe country. And the reason why they said it's a safe country is because we contested the ban. Because he wanted to include Iraq in the ban. He said it was a dangerous country. And we said, no, we don't want to ban people from coming to America. So since the court struck it down, he was so childish, he came back and he said, okay, well, if you don't want to ban Iraq, then it's perfectly safe to deport them.
Gee.
That's what the response was from our president, the president of the United States.
So what's the status on all of that? Is it being fought in court?
Yeah, so we do have attorneys set up with everybody who was affected. Most people have had bond hearings and are now out on bond. It was very scary though, because when you get picked up from ICE, typically there's a 48-hour deportation notice. So they try to deport you within 48 hours unless you stop it.
Yeah, very funny.
So, you know, we had to file a lot of emergency orders, and I can tell you right now, nobody has been deported. Out of everyone that was picked up, no one's been deported. We got the ACLU involved, and we're fighting it. And, you know, the courts are on our side. It doesn't matter what the vision of the president is. He can look at things and say, this is what I promised my base, I'm going to do. The courts are there to do the right thing. It is never right to send someone to a war, no matter what they did. We cannot continue to allow people to face persecution and torture and stuff like that.
Yeah, and a lot of them had religious persecution as well. Many of these are Iraqi Christians, not all of them, but many of them are Iraqi Christians. And from what I've been reading, even after ISIS has been basically booted out of Iraq, the Muslims that are still in charge there are continuing to persecute the Christians. So if you're a Christian, there really isn't a peaceful solution over there for you.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll go as far as to say this. There are a lot of Muslims being persecuted by Muslims as well.
That's true. The different sects that don't agree with each other.
Yes. I can tell you right now that you know, it started off with Christianity. But ISIS, they are not a religious group. They are going after everyone. They're going after Muslims now. They started off with the message, we're going to persecute Christians. They went after the Christians. But after they took over the Bank of Mosul and they got funding and they got weapons and they got membership, they just started taking over everyone.
Yeah. On another issue, one of the biggest issues in any election is the economy and jobs. And we always hear candidates run on a platform of, I'm going to stand up for a stronger economy, and they usually don't have any details on that. So I'd like to ask you, James, and listeners, if you've just tuned in, we're speaking with James Elia, who is a candidate in the Democratic Party who's running for the 71st Assembly District seat currently held by Republican Randy Vopel. What specific ideas do you have to bring jobs to East County? And I'm not talking McDonald's. I'm talking, you know, good paying jobs that people could use to support a middle class family.
Miriam, I could speak a couple hours just on this topic, so I'll give you some summaries.
The highlights, yeah.
Number one, we are severely crippling the youth of the nation. We are really putting them at a disadvantage. And really, I mean, like I said, we're making it impossible to get ahead. So one aspect of my platform is I've signed on to the 48 Fix, which is legislation that is going to be coming through the House this year. Mm-hmm. And the 48 Fix creates tuition-free college in the state of California. And what it does is over the course of 30 years, you end up paying an extra $48 in taxes.
Wow,
now,
that's
here's
it, huh?
Now, here's the thing. $48 over 30 years is such a small amount, you don't notice it.
Right.
But people still say they don't want their taxes raised. You know, that's still a problem. So we're working on some nicks and kinks in it to make it a little more strong to where you aren't coming out and saying, you know, you're raising my taxes. But I believe tuition-free college is the key. And second, we need to lure the workforce back. So East County is the haven of blue-collar workers.
Right.
There are so many construction workers out there. There are so many skilled laborers out there mm-hmm. that we're facing a crisis in California.
Well, we are. We've seen a lot of the factory jobs go away, too. A lot of these people that live in East County. You know, my dad was one of them. He used to work for General Dynamics. Dad's gone now, and so is General Dynamics. But they used to employ 17,000 people, and you could go work an assembly line, or in his case, he was an engineer, and make a pretty good living to take care of your family, whether you lived in East County or somewhere else. Those jobs are long gone.
Absolutely, but guess what? We could bring them right back. Why can't we? This is my proposal.
Let's hear it.
I want to put $200 million into apprenticeship programs in the state of California. It's not because I want to reward the workforce. It's because we need it. We need it. We're expected to be down 1.1 million labor jobs by 2022. The only way we're going to get those jobs back is by luring them in. People have left. They've gone to coding. They've gone to tech. We need to bring back, number one, skilled labor and trade. Once we do that, we can bring back factories. Now, how are we going to bring back factories? This bullet train that's being built to go to Las Vegas, it's a really cool idea, but how are we going to generate any revenue from it?
Yeah, good question.
This is how we do it. We build freight tracks going east to west instead of just building north to south. Add a little bit to the budget for the bullet train. Build some cargo tracks out there so we can have factories where they can actually get freight and start manufacturing again.
Yeah.
Now everyone says, how are you going to get companies to come back to California? The tax rate's insane and, you know, they're never going to work in a liberal state like this. You know what? If a company doesn't want to work in California, good. We'll see you later. We don't need you. We can use the same model that they use in Europe. Why don't we have employee-owned factories again? How come the iron workers don't get together and have their own factory? How come the sheet metal workers don't get with the iron workers? That way, once they produce the metal, they can then manipulate it and cut it and send it to size however they want to do it. It's been a successful platform all around the world. And the great thing about it is if we had employee-owned factories, we could create 2,000 to 3,000 jobs per factory. We can pay $60,000 to $70,000 a year, great wages. And we can still sell the product for as cheap as China and Russia because we don't have a board of directors that we have to pay. We don't have shareholders that we have to pay. We don't have a president, a CEO that we have to pay. You're literally paying workers to create products for the American people. How much more blue collar and American does it get than that?
Well, James, we are running out of time for the interview, but I want to give you the last word. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about you or your candidacy for the 71st Assembly District?
Folks, I can talk all day about myself, but I would much rather just get down to the nitty-gritty and tell you what I represent. You can go to my website, www.eliaforassembly.com.
And it's spelled E-L-I-A.
E-L-I-A-F-O-R, assembly.com. And I do have my platform up there. The most important aspect on my platform is public banking. I really think that banks have manipulated us for the longest time. I don't think this is anything having to do with Democrats versus Republicans. It is a class warfare situation. It is the wealthy versus us. So I really do think a public bank where we create tons of revenue, where we're no longer rewarding the banks for manipulating us, this is the most important thing on my platform. So please get to my website. If you want to hear more about it, you can register and you can sign up for my email list. Or better yet, you can ask me to give you a call and we can speak anytime you like.
Very good. An accessible candidate. All right. I want to thank you very much, James, for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you so much, Miriam.